The Hermit of Rainsborough. Talk of the journals was put on hold while Elsie and Tricia finished straightening up the damage done by the sheriff earlier that morning. Greg excused himself to go to the courthouse to file a complaint about Sheriff Hill's warrantless search. When Greg returned, he suggested that they all leave in anticipation of the sheriff finding some reason to throw all three of them back in jail. Elsie collected a few of her belongings in a suitcase, and soon the trio was headed out of the county. Greg went ahead with Elsie so that he could get to his office in Chillicothe and arrange for a safe place for her to live. Tricia tarried just a little bit longer before deciding that she needed to get back to Magnolia for her own safety. She had just gotten into her car when her cell phone rang. "Oak was at Zeke's this morning," Glenn informed her from the other end. "He only stayed long enough to give me a note with an address." Glenn repeated the content of Hoke's note while Tricia jotted it down. "It's on the way," Tricia informed him. "Did Hoke say where he might be found?"
Maybe at that address, but I doubt it. He said something about having to be out of touch for a while before he left."
Tricia finished the phone call, wondering what might be found at the address from Hoke's note. The thought hit her that maybe that's where she could find his father. She examined the note she transcribed. Hoke's instructions were quite clear. Tricia drove east out of Hillsborough, turning off the main highway in the small town of Rainsborough, where she found a small, unexceptional single-story house with the name King on the mailbox. The rain which had dogged her since leaving Hillsborough let up just long enough for her to go from her car to the front door of the house without getting wet.
"Bell don't knock, please bump."
Before she could decide whether she should knock or try the doorbell anyway, the door opened. On the other side was an old man, presumably Mr. King. He was broad-shouldered. At one time, he would most likely have been muscular. That side of him was gone now, as was most of his hair. He was left with a sparse covering of white, a mane to be proud of. His eyes were piercing. She felt as if he were searching her inner being, able to read it and shape it to his will.
"You from the state?" he growled.
"I came alone. Hoke sent me." He immediately stood down, inviting her in. She was surprised to see that his home was well ordered, almost with military precision. War had certainly touched this man and the way he lived his life in peace.
"You are Mr. King, right?" she asked. "That's what folks call me, Harry King. That's what I call myself."
His answer was sure, steadfast, never wavering.
Did Hoke tell you anything different, young lady?"
"Well, he hinted that you might be hiding behind a name you've adopted. You might have the same name as your son."
"Yes? Yes, I do," he stated.
The man invited her to sit down on a sofa in a corner on a well-worn recliner. He sat down on that recliner, settling his head on a pillow which had been attached to the headrest.
"My son's name is the same as my name. I abandoned the name I was born with when I found that it was being used to excuse acts which have no excuse."
She looked at the man's face, then recalled seeing a photograph of the man behind that face in a file in the basement of the sheriff's office in Prentice.
"Could I guess that name?" she asked.
"I think you already know it," he replied. "But we will not speak that name, not in this house, not now." "You know something about the disappearance of Jim and Nadine Brown back in the fall of 1967? Tricia and Harry King left the question float around the room for a while before he replied.
"I'm not an eyewitness to all of the events of that morning, although I've been painted as a principal culprit. Pardon me, would you like something to drink? A Dr. Pepper?"
Tricia politely declined. He got up, disappeared in the back of the house for a while, then came back with a carbonated soft drink and a glass. She assumed it was Dr. Pepper.
"I was working that morning," he started, as if he had not interrupted himself. "I was in the turnaround at the foot of Possum Hollow hiding from Sheriff Ross. If he knew where I was at, he would have ended my life with a shotgun and hid my body in that barn of his. They was pouring a foundation later that day, and no one would have thought about looking to see what was in there before going and pouring all that concrete."
Nadine Brown, Tricia thought.
If Fred's story about seeing her killed was true, she might have been entombed in the barn. Not too long before sunrise, another patrol car turned off the main highway and headed up the holler. It wasn't one of ours. It was attached to the Lawrence County office. Harry stopped and took a long drink from his beverage. I didn't think about timing, but maybe 10, maybe 15 minutes later, the Lawrence County car come back down the holler at a pretty fair clip. Instead of heading to the right, though, he headed left towards Prentice. "Do you know who might have been driving that car?" she asked. Harry smiled. "Wasn't me, like everyone else said it was," he said. "It was most likely Johnny Ross's younger brother, Joey." "Johnny Ross had a younger brother?" "I met him when we were in Korea. Joey Ross and me both got drafted, sent there by a judge, and forced to send our paychecks home to the girls we knocked up. We found other ways to make money so we'd have cash of our own. None of them was exactly legal, but we never got caught. I come to find out that Joey's family was doing the same thing stateside as he was in Korea. There was the booze and the gambling, and there was the woman. People in dire straits with young daughters are more than willing to sell them for cash for the rest of the family. It's true in Korea. It's true here." "Now, you were telling me about the morning of October the 5th, 1967, Tricia reminded her host, fearing he'd gone off on a tangent. He paused for several moments. Harry made a face, then continued where he left off. "Joey went up the hollow regular to visit his brother, especially when something big was going to happen. My guess was that they were about to make a procurement run when I saw Joey go up the holler." "A procurement run?" "Johnny Ross, his brothers, and Lou Gilbert bought and sold women, Mrs. Michaels. They specialized mostly in younger girls. Some of them they sold as brides to older men. Some of them they sent down to the river where they could put them to work in the whorehouses. It was a nasty business, Mrs. Michaels. Nasty business." He finished his drink, ambled into the back of the house for a moment, then came back out. He sat back in his chair and resumed his ramble. "Where was I? Oh, yes, the whorehouses. I found out about them about the time I came out of the Army. I mustered out at Fort Knox and headed back home here to Highland County by way of the Queen City. Joey came out at the same time. We both hitched a ride to Covington. He told me that his brother was involved in some business in the red light district. We're a couple of horny kids, and when we got there, we found ourselves knee-deep in girls. We stayed there a week, meeting one of Joey's uncles and some other brother while we were there." "Now, you saying that you and Joey continued doing what you did when you were doing in Korea when you got out of the Army?" "Yeah," he affirmed. "Only here we had to put a legitimate face on what we were doing. Joey's family had Lou Gilbert to back them up. Lou had connections in most of the area. He even managed to get Johnny Ross and his other brother Jerry as their jobs as sheriffs. When Joey came back, he got him a job as a deputy in Lawrence County and got me a job as a deputy in Fuller County." From everything Harry King was telling her, she was starting to think that he was, in fact, Quentin Russell. She casually asked him if she could take his picture on her phone. He politely declined his permission. "If certain people found out who I really am, they'd have the law on me faster than you can blink, Mrs. Michaels. As I said, Mrs. Michaels, I'll not have that name repeated in this house." "I understand," Tricia told him. "From what I've heard, you'd be ripped apart in no time." "Funny thing is, I'd be ripped apart for deeds I'd never done. Gilbert Ross would see to it that the legal system would punish me for what I did to his family." "I take it that Gilbert Ross was part of the Klan?" "Well, he was Joey's son, the one Joey had to support when he was in Korea. Joey took the boy under his wing when the kid turned 10. His mother and his mother's kin didn't want him to, so Joey took him in, just like I took in my kid when he became too much for his mother to handle when he turned 14. I heard second or third hand that the person who went to the Brown house that morning had a younger accomplice with him," Tricia interrupted. "You're saying that the accomplice was Gilbert Ross?" I didn't see no one else in the patrol car other than Joey, other than either going up or coming back down the holler. Jim told me later that he saw Gilbert too, although he had no idea who the boy was at the time. "You saw Jim Brown after Joey Ross came down the hollow?" she asked. "I met him when he was going up the holler. He was hoofing it down as fast as he could make it." "You went up after Joey Ross came down and headed out towards Prentice?" He nodded. "I picked Jim up and headed back to Jackson. On the way, he told me what happened. When we got there, I came up with a plan to hide him for his own good." Evasion. A million questions rolled through Tricia Michael's mind. Her primary question was about who she was talking to had been answered, although not directly, by the man himself. Apparently, the man who murdered Nadine Brown on the morning in October was not the same man blamed for the murder. Harry King interrupted his narrative to take a trip to the bathroom. In such a small house, every sound related to his bodily functions was heard in every corner. There was no real privacy. The feeling was much the same as it was in Lebanon when she visited Jimmy in prison. You were isolated from the rest of the world, yet you were exposed to everyone who shared your isolation. Harry's home had become his own personal prison. He came back with another drink in hand. At least he could have his own vice and enjoy it in peace. What exactly were you doing that you were able to place Joey Ross in Possum Hollow at the time of Jim and Nadine Brown's disappearance? She blurted out the question before she could settle back down in his chair. "I was looking for him." His answer was short and to the point. "Jim Brown was a friend. He had gotten in over his head. Against my advice, he borrowed money from Lou Gilbert. The loan was past due, and the only way he could pay back what he owed was to give up his oldest girl. The Ross boys needed some fresh meat, and they were willing to pay off the loan in exchange for the girl." "Weren't you Lou Gilbert's enforcer?" "Yes, I was their enforcer. But I'd been also stealing money from Lou Gilbert and the Ross boys," he answered. "By the time all this was happening, they were pretty well on to me. At least that's what I found out later. I was still the enforcer, but I was real selective about how I went about my business. You see, there are certain people I wouldn't touch. Like Jim." "Jim Brown was a friend. We spent time together. I'd go visit my grandpa in this little town in West Virginia for a couple of weeks every summer. Jim's mother and my mother went to school together. His mother stayed while my mother left. When Mom went home, she and Ella Mae Brown would get together, meaning that me and Jim would go and find things to do and get mischief to get into. We went our separate ways for a long time. I went to Korea. He stayed and started a family, moving out west here to Ohio for greener pastures. When I got back and started working for Lou and the Ross boys, we rekindled the old friendship and never let go." "You said that you met him coming down Possum Hollow the morning he disappeared," Tricia stated. "Tell me, what happened after you met him?" "He gave me the short version of what happened inside of a minute after I let him into my car. We'd already talked about what was likely to happen after that, so we decided to take the ride over to Jackson and wait. On the way over, he gave me the long version." "Weren't you afraid, or was he afraid of what might have happened to the children?" she asked. "Well, the fact of the matter is, what we knew, we had time. All the kids except for the two youngest had to go to school that morning. David would stay home and take care of them. Sheriff Ross wouldn't touch them, at least until someone would call in to report the Browns missing. That alarm would most likely be raised by the local truant officer, meaning we had at least until noon to figure out what to do." "Are you saying you had planned this out ahead of time?" "Well, not the way it happened, no," he told her. "There was the plan, but we figured that the Ross boys would act out their parts completely differently. We figured that the hammer would drop on Saturday. The original plan was to move the Browns to another place in the middle of the night on Friday night, so when the Ross boys showed up, there'd be no one to take with them. And you would be there protecting them and their whereabouts." "That's about it. Yep." He took a long draft of his drink before offering Tricia another chance of a drink of her own. This time she accepted. He went back out into the kitchen, coming back just a few minutes later with a drink for her. "Why didn't the sheriff just go ahead and take the children into protective custody when he arrived that afternoon?" 'cause Rachel Parrish from the county home got there first. She was in on the deal from the word go. Her family had a farm in Fairfield County where the Browns would have gone to live if the original plan had stayed in place. I called her that morning, told her what happened, and she worked it so that she would have the children in custody, or at least have been in place when the call came and the parents were missing. The children got scattered, and the sheriff never got what was coming to her, or coming to him. Tricia saw her host smile as she said that. You're pretty damn satisfied with the outcome, weren't you? I sure was, young lady. Sheriff Ross ended up losing his bid for a sixth term. Jim and David got away, and for the most part, the other kids ended up in better circumstances than they would have otherwise. Jim and David got away? I thought David got killed in an auto accident not long after his parents disappeared. Harry smiled and chuckled softly. David's death was staged. Sheriff Ross and Lou Gilbert never knew any better. They were shamed into buying a plot and an empty coffin, as well as headstones for Jim, David, and Nadine. The only Brown buried in the Possum Hollow Cemetery is Evan. A million more questions crossed Trisha's mind. Only one came out of her mouth. Is Jim Brown still alive? Just a minute, she was told. Harry got up from his seat and disappeared in the back of his house. He came back 5 minutes later with a pair of filing boxes loaded on a lightweight dolly. I spent a lot of time keeping my own records of what went on the Fuller County Sheriff's Office when I was in there. I figured that sometime someone would sift through what I've collected and clear my name of the terrible things they said I did. I ain't got long to live, and neither does Jim Brown. Jim has several journals telling what happened. He needs to clear his name, too, for the good of his children. David's told me that you are up on the up and up, that if anyone could blow the whistle on those bastards, you can. I need you to take these, sort through them, and find a way to have justice served.